I think we've got not everybody, but I believe at least somebody from each party here. What we have decided to do is we're going to get started and go move ahead with the schedule here. We need to, at 4 o'clock, no matter where we are in the schedule, have the cross-examination of the state agencies. We have some of those folks here, and they're not necessarily able to stay until later on. So what we'll do is we'll, when we get to 4 o'clock, we'll stop. We'll do the cross-examination of state agencies, and then recess for dinner from 5:15 to 6, and then 6 o'clock we have to be back here for this evening's public hearing. And I wish, we're thinking maybe we'll have fewer people than last night, and then we'll be able to pick up on whatever, if anything, we still need to do in the party testimony of the schedule there. Anybody has any real concerns about that, I guess I'm giving you the heads up now, and if you want to voice that at some point. I think we've been doing pretty well. We are a little bit behind, and I know that my impression is everybody's doing their best with the schedule that we've got here. I think, was there anything else I was going to say?
The exhibits.
I'm sorry, I've got...
When we left, we had the issue of the exhibits on the table. I'm assuming that you guys worked that out and that... Okay, and so TransCanada has provided copies of those to Marcia, the ones that you cited.
Okay, I have one other request. Folks are having difficulty hearing, so if you're at the mic, please speak up. And I'm going to be a little more insistent in asking you to do so. So why don't we get going? And I guess it's the testimony by the consolidated parties first. 1:55. Okay. 20. All right. Go ahead.
Is this on? There we go. All right. Good afternoon, commissioners. My name is David Publicover. I'm a senior staff scientist with the Appalachian Mountain Club, where I've been employed since 1992. The decision that LIRC faces is an important one and will have significant precedential value in determining where the Commission draws the line between appropriate and inappropriate sites for wind power development. One of the policies for mountain resources in the club is to protect high mountain resources with particularly high natural resource values or sensitivity, which are not appropriate for most development. The question is CISC such an area? And we believe that it clearly is. The Fir Heartleaf Birch Subalpine Forest Community, which will be the focus of my testimony, which covers the southern half of the project area, is classified by the Maine Natural Areas Program as S3, defined as rare in Maine on the order of 20 to 100 occurrences, though not, to our knowledge, imminently imperiled. A list provided by the Natural Areas Program, included in my testimony, lists 19 currently documented occurrences in the state. And even given that there are most likely other undocumented occurrences, this community is at the low end of the number of occurrences for this ranking. Now, the applicant's environmental assessment states, and I quote, "In western Maine, however, it is relatively common and is found on many of the ridges that are higher than 3,000 feet in elevation." I believe this statement is highly misleading. The 19 documented occurrences of this community encompass just 0.2% of the state's land area. And even including the potential additional area listed by Dr. Hudson would increase this to less than 0.25% of the state, less than 0.25% of the state. And even within the Western Mountains region, where it is concentrated, it makes up no more than 1 to 1.5% of the landscape. This cannot be considered common by any reasonable understanding of the word. This rare natural community is an important component of the state's biological heritage. It provides the core breeding habitat for Bicknell's thrush, one of the state's highest conservation priority species. It is recognized as a distinct and high-priority habitat in a range of conservation plans, including the state's Comprehensive Wildlife Conservation Strategy. It is also likely to have important adaptive value in the face of future climate change by maintaining spruce fir habitat on the landscape when this habitat has been greatly reduced or eliminated at lower elevations. The occurrence of this community on Sisk Mountain lies in the middle of the size range for occurrences documented by the Natural Areas Program and is typical for occurrences outside of the state's largest mountain ranges. It was rated as good or B-ranked, a good or B-ranked occurrence. Now, the three factors that go into this rating, which are condition, size, and landscape context, this occurrence received the highest rating for its undisturbed and natural condition. It is essentially pristine. Thus, while this occurrence may not be considered the best of the best, it certainly cannot be considered a minor or insignificant occurrence. One of the two policies pertaining to mountain resources in the CLUP is to regulate high mountain areas to, among other things, preserve scenic value, vegetative communities, unique wildlife communities, and low-impact recreational opportunities. The Sisk Ridgeline is clearly significant regarding scenic value, vegetative communities, and unique wildlife communities. Now, based on the map included with TransCanada's pre-filed testimony, the project would eliminate or indirectly impact nearly 30% of this community occurrence. It would create over a mile of permanent artificial edge exposed to strong prevailing winds, creating the potential for extensive blowdown and changes to the microclimate in the remaining area. This is far beyond what can legitimately be considered a minimal impact. While the applicant has stated that they have minimized the potential for impact, this is not the standard by which the project should be judged. The project must be judged on the impact that will actually occur. We believe that this level of impact to a significant occurrence of a rare natural community constitutes an undue adverse impact and is grounds for rejection of the application. To date, no wind power project in the state has been permitted that would have such a considerable impact on a documented occurrence of a rare natural community. Approval of this project would set an unfortunate precedent, considerably lower the threshold of what types of impacts are considered acceptable, and would be contrary to LIRC's mandate to protect the important natural resource values of the jurisdiction. And I pass it over to Susan Gallo.
Is that a pointer over there? Did you put a laser? By any chance?
Hi. Oh, maybe it's not. Oh, it is. Hi. My name is Susan Gallo. Go ahead for the first slide. And I'm a wildlife biologist at Maine Audubon. And I've worked there for 12 years working broadly on bird conservation issues and forest ecology issues across the state. I'm presenting an extremely brief summary of the undue adverse impacts this project poses to Bicknell's thrush. So to start with, these are the points I'm going to cover, but I'm just going to go to the heart of it here. The first point I want to make is that you can see the map. This map demonstrates how rare Bicknell's thrush breeding habitat is in the U.S. These are the only places in the U.S. where this bird occurs. Of course, it does occur in Canada to the north and east of us. But this is it for this bird. You've heard repeatedly that this bird is a habitat specialist on stunted high elevation spruce fir forest. Next slide. This limited breeding range and similarly limited habitat, as previous folks have mentioned in Hispaniola, is one of the main factors making this bird one of the highest conservation priorities in our region. So the lack of threatened or endangered listing for this species in no way diminishes its value as a species in need of conservation. Multiple conservation agencies and organizations from state, national, and international groups are in agreement that Bicknell's thrush is a species of global conservation concern, a very high priority, a species of continental concern facing multiple threats. That's the next point I want to make, is that there are multiple threats facing this species. There's no consensus for any top threats. If you look across these multiple organizations, there are many threats, and this is just a sample of the kinds of threats they face on both breeding and wintering grounds. And it's important to consider our role in preventing undue adverse impacts from threats to the species that we control here on its breeding ground. So the next slide, in terms of what we can control, is breeding habitat, how much we have, and to what measures we go to protect it. So that you've seen this slide before. The red is the core habitat that was designated. The red hatched. The red outline is the suitable Bicknell thrush habitat that was delineated. And then these yellow, these are from Peter Vickery's pre-file testimony. This is the 8 acres that was the applicant has said is affected by this project. So one of our main points is we believe that the 8 acres is a gross underestimate of the habitat that will be affected by this project. So the next slide. This is taken from the Folsom and Evers report that we got late last week. And just to sort of set the stage, I don't want to take too much time on technical details, but I do think it's important to look at where the applicant looked for Bicknell thrush. So these black points are where they did 10-minute point counts throughout the summer of 2009, and then these black circles are roughly 10-hectare plots where where folks searched for birds, the spot mapping technique that's mentioned in the application. So to the next slide, just one more quick piece of background information is Dana Blue already talked about these dots. This core habitat was delineated based on actual Bicknell thrush observations. So this is sort of a connect the dots approach where these are the birds in the outer sort of envelope of observations, and that's how that core habitat was designated. And that's part of the problem we believe in the designation of this core habitat. So taking this figure from the next slide. So I just want to illustrate really quickly an example of why we think this is an underestimate. So this blue dot here is a Bicknell thrush that was observed. Next slide. If you overlay a habitat, this is roughly an 8-acre circle. It's, as Peter Vickery pointed out, that's a minimum size for a female Bicknell thrush. And one of the pieces of information we don't have about the work that was done was where a bird's territory is relative to where it was observed. So it could have been in the center of the territory like this. Next slide, one more. It could have been on the outer edge, which would have put the habitat on the inside of that core. And finally, it also could have been, next slide, it could have been on the inside edge of this territory. So there's not really anything saying in the information that we have, there's nothing telling us where this bird's territory is. This area wasn't searched. Where this bird's territory falls relative to the point where it was observed changes the amount of habitat impacted by this project. And we believe we need to interpret the data that was collected more liberally than it has been. And just to show you, to extrapolate, next slide. If you do this to multiple points, and I'm not saying that every point necessarily, but just a sample of theoretically what could actually be impacted. So these circles are just extrapolating a couple of different territories. This is an 8-acre circle. The next slide shows a 13.4-acre circle, which again, as Peter Vickery pointed out, is the larger edge of the range for territory sizes. So the way the data was collected for this bird does not preclude this interpretation of results. And as also mentioned earlier by the earlier panel, these birds move, Bicknell thrush move around based on what happens in their habitat from year to year. Combine the dynamic habitat with a different interpretation of the data, and we believe that much more than 8 acres of habitat will be lost by this project. In addition to the direct impacts, the direct loss of habitat, we think it's an error to say there are no edge effects to this project, so that we believe there are changes to the habitat beyond the project footprint that will result in indirect habitat loss. For example, the edges of roads in the project. We don't believe that this is similar to a logging road or to a natural disturbance. This is a dramatic edge effect on a very different habitat. Finally, The last point I want to make quickly is that we believe LURC should evaluate the adverse impacts from collisions. Bicknell thrush are unusual for a forest songbird in their use of aerial flight displays. The flights, as we mentioned, can go up to more than 200 feet and bring them well into the core of the rotor swept area at dusk in the project area. And no, we do not know the risk of collision for Bicknell thrush. What we do know is that birds making aerial flight displays in grasslands, we know, are more susceptible to mortality from collision. These are three species that are common in grasslands, common mortality events for these species. So we have reason to be concerned that the project with turbines in core Bicknell thrush habitat will result in undue impacts from collisions. So just to summarize, the points we would like to make, that I would like to make for Bicknell thrush, is that the burden of proof for undue adverse impacts to this natural resources have not been met in this project. We believe there's much more than 8 acres of habitat that will be affected, especially habitat beyond the identified core. We think the search areas were limited, and so we feel the data that they present must be interpreted with caution. And finally, the risk of collisions are unknown, but the behavior makes this bird susceptible, and other birds in other habitats who have experienced collisions, we believe, raises a red flag of caution. And I will pass it on to Kathy.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Johnson. I've been the Northwoods Project Director at the Natural Resources Council of Maine for 20 years, and I've been hiking, camping, and paddling in Maine's Northwoods for 40 years. The Sisk area has multiple scenic resources of state or national significance. It has 7 ponds rated outstanding for scenic values by the Maine Wildlands Lakes Assessment, including the 5 ponds that make up the chain of ponds, plus Arnold and Crosby ponds. And it also has the Benedict Arnold Trail to Quebec Historic District, which is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. In addition, a scenic byway, one of only 12 in Maine, winds up the valley. The byway is noted for, and I quote, its outstanding, close quote, scenery. While NRCM Maine Audubon and AMC have been and continue to be strong supporters of wind development, we believe that in this case, the major adverse impacts that the 7 southern turbines would have on these scenic resources, along with the adverse impacts that Dave and Susan spoke about to ecological and wildlife resources, cause an unreasonably adverse impact and tip the scales against approval of this project as it is currently configured. The most severe impacts to scenic resources and related uses would be on the ponds that make up the chain of ponds. As is apparent from the applicant's photo simulation viewpoint 5 that we looked at this morning, the most significant impacts would be on Long Pond, the middle of the 5 ponds. BPL maintains a primitive campsite and hand-carry boat launch onto the south end of Long Pond. The campsite is beautiful, with views to the marshes and mountains to the west away from the proposed wind project. From this campsite and hand-carry site, you can paddle around and up Long Pond towards points leading into Natanis Pond, or down through the thoroughfare into Bag Pond, which would also be significantly adversely impacted by the turbines. BPL maintains another primitive campsite on Bag Pond. When you're out on the water, and I realize you didn't have a chance to do that yesterday, and I'm sorry that you didn't, because from the water, from the middle of these ponds, as you look to the east, the view that you see is the Sisk Ridge, framed on the right-hand side by Sisk Mountain, and on the left-hand side, other way around from your view, left-hand side by Pisgah, and on the right-hand side by Sisk Mountain. This is a ridge several miles long on which the turbines would sit in plain view of any person who's out on the water of Long Pond. While the bird life on the ponds, eagles, ospreys, loons, pileated woodpeckers, is abundant, your view would inevitably be drawn to these large wind turbines, the closest of which is less than 3 miles away. As LURC's consultant Jim Palmer noted in his report, the view of the turbines from the lower part of Long Pond is, quote, most certainly prominent by any definition and may be considered collectively dominant. I completely agree. Chain of Ponds has a special attraction because of its location. Being extremely accessible to the scenic byway, It provides an opportunity for families, recreationists, and visitors to camp and paddle in gorgeous, natural, undeveloped surroundings without having to venture onto unpaved and unmarked logging roads, something that's daunting to folks unfamiliar with Maine's Northwoods. The Bureau of Parks and Lands, in its management plan, has recognized the scenic beauty and the unusual recreational niche of this region in its management plan, and has designated significant portions of the unit for special scenic management as proposed to add additional primitive campsites. BPL has also identified a growing interest in the region in backcountry ATV touring and camping. BPL notes in its management plan that the draw for most recreationists of all types is the region's, quote, wild and scenic, close quote, character. The photo simulations prepared by Gene Vissering show that 14 turbines would be visible from viewpoint 5 on Long Pond. We've taken the liberty of identifying which of those turbines would be the southern turbines and which would be the 7 southern ones and then the northern ones. If you only look at the northern turbines, the adverse impacts on the chain of ponds would be significantly lessened, but not gone altogether. So that's what it would look like if you only looked at the northern turbines. Paddlers who choose to paddle the length of the chain of ponds under the proposed project would see turbines along almost one-third of the distance of the ponds. 31% was what Gene Vissering testified to. And about half of that distance, they would see 9 or more turbines. And this is the map from Gene Vissering's testimony, and I realize it's hard, so I'll just encourage you to go look at it as when you're reviewing the data. But the colors in the middle of that map show how many turbines would be visible from where. So let's see if I can hold my hand straight. So you would see turbines from the south end of Natanas Pond down the whole length of Lawn Pond and into the western side of Bag Pond. If we only consider the impacts from the 8 northern turbines, if you didn't see the 7 southern turbines, you would only see impacts in this much smaller area, only about 10% of the ponds in the southern end of Long Pond and a piece of the western side of Bag Pond. We believe that the impacts of the southern 7 turbines on scenic resources and related uses so significantly compromise these resources and related uses that they cause an unreasonable adverse impact, and no permit should be granted for those southern 7 turbines. The northern 8 turbines are a little different. There would still be significant adverse scenic impacts on Chain of Ponds, Arnold and Crosby Ponds, and Kibby Stream. And we believe that LURC should require, as a condition of any permit that LURC may issue, measures to mitigate those impacts. The conditions on the permit to mitigate for the adverse impacts of the turbines on scenic resources would be different from and in addition to those measures that the applicant is required in order to provide tangible benefits. Tangible benefits are required regardless of whether there are adverse impacts and should be in addition to any actions required as a condition of a permit to mitigate for adverse impacts. One other point I wanted to make is that in addition, if only you were looking at the northern 8 turbines, all of the adverse impacts that would result from the road that was discussed this morning with Gene Vissering, that road that's visible from Long Pond is servicing the 7 southern turbines, so that road would not be there if the 7 southern turbines were not there. And as in some places, it's our understanding that the slope on that road will be 30 to 40%, very steep. And as the gentleman who testified last night mentioned, the roads can have as big a scenic impact from the ponds as the turbines themselves. So thank you very much.
Good.